This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. This article is from the July 2025 issue and is entitled Home of the Clouds, written by Annette McGivney. For more than 1,000 years, the Hopi people have referred to the second highest peak in present-day Arizona as Umwaki, which means Home of the Clouds. Today, after a years-long effort led by students at Flagstaff High School's Native American Club, the Sacred Mountain is one step away from having its prehistoric name reinstated. You don't need a PhD in anthropology to decipher the names of many of Arizona's landmarks. The Grand Canyon is just that. The Vermilion Cliffs radiate a deep red at sunset. The Salt River flows over large sodium deposits, and South Mountain once marked the southern boundary of the Phoenix metro area. But there also are plenty of landmarks named after people, and the reasons for these honorary designations are often blurred by the passage of time and patchy historical accounts. Agassiz Peak, Arizona's second highest summit, fell into this ambiguous category until a group of determined indigenous students started asking questions. Agassiz Peak is part of the San Francisco Peaks, a ring of mountains crowning a dormant volcano just north of Flagstaff. At 12,356 feet, Agassiz is slightly shorter than nearby 12,633-foot Humphreys Peak. And while Humphreys, named in 1873 for U.S. Army General Andrew Atkinson Humphreys, claims the high point of the peaks in Arizona, it's south-facing Agassiz that dominates Flagstaff skyline. Robert Brunig, the former executive director of the Museum of Northern Arizona, does hold a Ph.D. in anthropology. He says Agassiz Peak got its name in 1867 during a survey expedition led by another Army general, William Jackson Palmer. The federal government was searching for a viable transcontinental railroad route along the 35th parallel, and Palmer was struck by the towering summit near the community that would become Flagstaff. Scientists were like rock stars back in those days, Brunig says, and even though Jean Louis Rodolphe Agassiz had never set foot in Arizona or laid eyes on the mountain, Palmer decided to name the peak in honor of the famous naturalist and professor who founded Harvard University's Museum of Comparative Zoology. A Swiss immigrant and contemporary of Charles Darwin, Agassiz had received acclaim for his numerous scientific studies in the mid-19th century, which ranged from glaciers to Amazon fish. Palmer just slapped a name on the map, Brunig says. I doubt it ever crossed his mind to ask the indigenous people of the area what they called the mountain. The way Euro-Americans went in during that time and named things was a form of colonial arrogance. The names they chose had nothing to do with the mountain itself or its spiritual value to indigenous people. The entire mountain range, named San Francisco by Franciscan friars in the early 1600s, is sacred to at least 13 tribes. In their own languages, the Acoma, Apache, Diné, Navajo, Havasupai, Hualapai, Mojave, Southern Paiute, and Zuni peoples each have a unique name for the peaks that dates to long before Europeans arrived in present-day Arizona. But after Flagstaff was founded in 1876, the name Agassiz became synonymous with the geographic identity of the town. As the decades passed and Flagstaff grew, the reason the peak was named after Harvard scientists faded, and whatever social inequities the name represented remained unexamined. But in March 2020, students at Flagstaff High School's Native American Club decided to investigate Louis Agassiz's background. The students read about Agassiz's scientific accomplishments and position at Harvard, but they discovered something else, that Agassiz promoted a racist pseudoscientific theory called polygenism. According to Brunig, it was an idea that each race was a separate species with separate divinely created origins. Adherents of the theory ranked races based on skull measurement to suggest cranial capacity reflected intelligence, with white people at the top and black people at the bottom, just below indigenous people. These so-called scientific findings were used to justify segregation and other policies against people of color. The revelations about Agassiz alarmed Native students and graduates, including Macias Marks, a member of the Navajo Nation. "Why is this peak named after eugenicists?" he recalls club members asking. "How come it isn't named something more respectful?" The students decided to address an injustice that had gone unchallenged for nearly 150 years. "We started to formulate a plan," Macias says. "We asked about the paperwork that needed to be filled out to change a name. Who do we need to convince? There were no easy answers. Unlike the 19th century frontier days, when explorers haphazardly named landmarks whatever they pleased, the geographic naming process is now tightly controlled, and multiple government agency permissions are required when the request involves public land, as it does with the peaks, which are in the Coconino National Forest. A years-long effort by the students to remove Agassiz's name from the sacred mountain would involve navigating city, state, and federal bureaucracies and even meeting with the scientists' descendants. But what the students didn't realize when they took on the project was that their effort to heal the past would also shape their futures. The Native American Club at Flagstaff High has been active for more than 50 years, according to club sponsor Daryl Marks, Macias' father. He says the club ranges from 40 to 70 students during the school year, depending on seasonal sport activities. About a quarter of the school's 1,600 students are indigenous, and while the club is open to all students, it focuses on supporting Natives who want to learn about their traditions and culture. For 46 years, the club has sponsored a well-attended spring powwow to raise money for its community service activities, which include mentoring elementary school students, providing food boxes to families in need, and helping students with college and career readiness. The club members also engage in environmental and social justice causes, which led to their 2020 investigation of Agassiz Peak. They move fast, Daryl recalls. Within a week of learning about the history of Agassiz, they wrote letters to Flagstaff City Council members and held a public press conference about how continued use of the name harmed Indigenous people. The City Council was impressed by the students' presentation. After a public process, Flagstaff changed the name of the city's Agassiz Street to honor Wilson Wiles, who was the first African-American student to attend Northern Arizona University and later worked to desegregate Flagstaff's public schools. But when the COVID-19 pandemic forced Flagstaff High to suspend in-person learning, the students' larger goal of renaming Agassiz Peak was put on hold until in-person classes resumed about 18 months later. One of the students' biggest questions, if Agassiz's name were removed, what name should take its place? The students set out to learn what their indigenous ancestors had called the peak, and Michaela So, who was attending the University of Arizona in Tucson after graduating from Flagstaff High in 2019, stepped in to help. I was so into my studies and I missed home, So recalls of that period in 2021. I was grasping for something to connect me to my roots, and I reached out to Mr. Marks for advice. So grew up on the Navajo Nation in the small community of Hard Rock. Her family moved to Flagstaff when she was in high school, and she was an active member of the Native American Club. Daryl suggested So use her connections with elders on tribal land to get their input on indigenous names for the peak. So found that interviewing members of various tribes about the sacred mountain was the antidote to her homesickness. She started her research by talking with her great-grandparents who lived in Hard Rock and speak only Diné. My great-grandparents have so many stories about our homeland, she says. When they tell these stories, you can see in their eyes how a part of them lights up. When Palmer, the Army general, traveled through present-day northern Arizona in 1967 for the railroad survey, the Navajo people had been removed from their homeland by the United States government and set on a forced march called the Long Walk. Some 3,500 died during the trek and subsequent four-year internment at Bosque Redondo in New Mexico. Then, in 1879, barely a decade after the Diné had returned to a reservation established on a slice of their homeland, the tribe's children, along with indigenous children across the United States, became the first of many generations forced into boarding schools where speaking their traditional language and practicing their culture were forbidden. So found this traumatic legacy made some tribal elders reluctant to talk about their culture or recall traditional place names that had been kept quiet for generations. And while the Diné called the entire mountain Duco Osliad, it seemed there weren't specific names for the individual summits. But So learned that the Hopi name for the peak rising above Flagstaff was Mumaki, which means home of the clouds. The peak summit was where precious moisture gathered before drifting northeast to the Hopi mesas to water life-sustaining crops. And the name Mumaki preceded the name Agassiz by at least 1,000 years. After So shared her research with the Native American Club, the students, members of a variety of tribes, were unanimously in support of the name Umwaki. The students' goal, Darrell recalls, became not to give the peak a new name, but to restore the name, go back to the original. Darrell's son, Marcus, who had graduated from Flagstaff High in 2019 and was attending NAU, also got involved. He submitted a name change proposal, the first step in a detailed review process to the U.S. and Arizona boards that deal with geographic names. As the students prepared to make their case to government agencies, they met via Zoom with Lakota elder and spiritual leader Basil Braveheart, who'd been instrumental in changing the name of Harney Peak, the highest summit in South Dakota, to Black Elk Peak in honor of a Lakota spiritual leader. The advice Basil gave us was that changing a name is not about asserting indigenous identity over others, Macias recalls. It is a restorative practice. It is about restoring our sense of belonging to one another and to our homeland. Meanwhile, some 2,500 miles away on the Harvard University campus, and unbeknownst to the students, the descendants of Louis Agassiz were also engaged in an effort to reckon with their ancestors' harmful legacy. When sisters Susanna and Marion Moore were growing up in the 1960s and 70s, they were told their great-great-great-grandfather, Louis Agassiz, was an acclaimed Harvard professor who made important scientific discoveries. We thought Agassiz was famous because he was so smart, Susanna says of the childhood beliefs she and her sister shared, and his intelligence was evidence that our family was special. As young adults, the two women came across vague references to the views of race that Agassiz promoted, but at that time they chose to remain ignorant of the disturbing information. I wish I had been curious instead of letting the shame overpower me, Susanna says. I didn't know how to look into it further without feeling tainted myself. Decades later, in 2019, the siblings' older sister forwarded Marion a front-page story in the New York Times about Agassiz's research at Harvard. He had commissioned daguerreotype portraits of slaves, and one of the subject's descendants, Tamara Lanier, was suing the university to have the images returned to her family. Susanna and Marion were appalled to learn the extent of the harm their ancestor had caused. This time I did not want to turn my back, but to go toward it, Marion says. The sisters and two of their nephews crafted an open letter signed by the four of them and 41 other Agassiz descendants to Harvard's president in support of Lanier's lawsuit. In the years that followed, as the lawsuit dragged on, Susanna and Marion also joined Lanier at speaking events representing a rare partnership between a descendant of slaves and the descendants of a scientist whose work was used to justify racist practices and policies. In 2021, news of the sisters' advocacy landed in the email inbox of Flagstaff resident Hillary Giovel, whose son was in eighth grade at the time. Giovel had been coordinating a letter-writing effort among Flagstaff middle school students in support of the Indigenous Youth Umwaki campaign. She contacted the sisters, hoping to get their help. They had no idea a peak in Arizona honored their ancestor, but they enthusiastically joined the campaign. After visiting with the Native American Club students, Susanna and Marion wrote a letter that was included in the submissions to the state and federal boards on geographic names. We recognize that it is a complex navigation to appropriately reckon with the extremely harmful, far-reaching effects of Agassiz's work while still honoring his positive contributions, the letter states. Some bemoan the spread of cancel culture in situations like these. We would suggest to these people that the culture that has been consistently canceled for over 500 years are the cultures of the indigenous people whose lands our ancestors have stolen. We suggest that it is past time to consult with these peoples and ask that they lead us in the restoration of the names of this and other sacred mountains. In October 2023, the six-member Arizona State Board on Geographic and Historic Names held a meeting via Zoom to consider the proposal to rename the peak Umwaki. In addition to the letter from the Agassiz family, the proposal had support from Flagstaff's mayor, tribal leaders, and the Coconino National Forest supervisor. Macias led the presentation on behalf of the club students and other indigenous youths from Flagstaff. A board member asked Macias if the Umaki proposal had received any pushback, especially from tribes other than the Hopi who might want the peak named in their own language. There is a shared understanding as to why it is called Home of the Clouds, Macias responded, noting that at public presentations, the name had always received a positive reception from both native and non-native people. Umaki reflects the environment, the community, and a spiritual connection to place, he added. According to David Breckner, executive director of the Arizona Historical Society and chair of the state panel, board members were very impressed and emotionally touched by the students' efforts. All the research they did and the way they consulted tribal elders and tribal governments was very powerful, he says. The state board voted unanimously in favor of the proposal, but the change is not official yet. Final approval for the name Umaki now rests with the U.S. Forest Service and the federal board. We hope they are continuing to work on this at the federal level and moving it forward, Breckner says. Neither the Forest Service nor the federal board responded to repeated inquiries about the status of the name change. While the Native American Club students and their supporters are hopeful Umaki will soon become the official name of the peak, the community-wide process of reclaiming the name has already proven to be healing and even life-changing. Gio Val, who is white, says removing the Agassi name in favor of Umaki would allow non-natives living in Flagstaff to establish a more honorable relationship with the mountain. It changes the consciousness of settlers to make us aware that we are on indigenous land still, she says, and that the mountain is sacred, a guardian watching over this whole region rather than a resource to be exploited. After these many weekends spent interviewing tribal elders, Sol realized she wanted her future to be focused on protecting indigenous culture and recovering traditional knowledge that was lost during the boarding school era. She switched her major from nursing to public management and policy, and she plans to graduate from the UA this December. She hopes to document more stories from elders and perhaps work for a public land management agency where she can advocate for more indigenous place names. When we gave public presentations, tribal elders would come up to us and say how proud they were of the native youth. So says, it meant a lot to see the positive impact we were having on them and the whole community. The work to change the name made me really happy inside. And this concludes Home of the Clouds. The next article is entitled The Trials of Travel in Early Arizona by Robert Trenert, traveling up the Colorado River aboard the steamboat Gila in August 1874, Army wife Martha Summerhays of New England could think of little beyond her own discomfort. The scenery was grand, she observed, and we could have a merry time, but for the awful heat, which destroyed both our good looks and our tempers. Mrs. Summerhays' reaction was typical of travelers in Arizona before the coming of the railroads. Because railroad construction did not commence until the 1880s, most uncomfortable forms of transportation, wagon train, stagecoach, and steamboat, sufficed for decades. Until the coming of Europeans, the native peoples traveled exclusively on foot. The Spaniards brought horses, oxen, and mules, relying for centuries on these animals to move them about the Southwest. Teams and wagons were used commonly to connect Tucson with Sonora, Mexico, but functional roads hardly existed elsewhere. The presence of Americans and the development of mining ventures caused widely scattered settlements to appear. In the late 1840s, gold fever struck California, prompting thousands of immigrants to head west across the southern Gila River route. To reach their destination, these Argonauts found it necessary to traverse Arizona. Thus, from the less demanding days of Spanish and Mexican occupation, Arizona suddenly needed a reliable transportation network to handle thousands of people on the move. Most of the early travelers provided for themselves. The U.S. Army, beginning with the Mormon Battalion in 1847, relied upon horses and mule-drawn wagons to open the first practical wagon road across the southern deserts. General Philip St. George Cook, commander of the battalion, recalled both the difficulties and the significance of his trip. Marching half naked and half fed and living upon wild animals, we have discovered and made a road of great value to our country. Nevertheless, travel in such a desolate country proved to be extremely arduous. One obviously unhappy man called Cook's Road the worst place for wagons to travel I ever saw. As if the topography was not enough of a hazard, herds of mean-spirited wild cattle roamed southern Arizona, occasionally attacking wagon trains and killing draft animals. The Mormon battalion once was attacked by a group of angry feral bulls in a skirmish forever known as the Battle of the Bulls. Under such circumstances, both men and animals suffered, particularly in the arid country between Tucson and the Gila River. John Durivage recalled that his portion of the trip very nearly killed him. Until one has crossed a barren desert without food or water under a burning tropical sun at a rate of 3 miles an hour, he can form no conception of what misery truly is. Some travelers on the southern trail were so dispirited by the slow pace that they resorted to rafting down the Gila. Such experiments, however, were abandoned after it was discovered that boats required more time to reach Yuma than did wagons. Not all travelers chose to travel with organized groups. One enterprising German immigrant decided to go west on his own by horseback, a trip that proved rather unpleasant when he was attacked by Indians. Scared but uninjured, he vowed that if the Indians did catch him, he would dismount and fight to the last, hand to hand, and sell my life as dearly as I can. Once soldiers were stationed in Arizona, travel accommodations improved. With escorts available and roads somewhat better, buckboards and carriages became commonplace. Martha Summerhays usually rode in a Doherty wagon, or in common army parlance, an ambulance. This practical frontier vehicle had a large body with two seats facing each other and a seat outside for the driver. The inside of the wagon could be closed if desired by canvas sides and back, which were rolled up and down. An ambulance might have given Mrs. Summerhays' privacy, but it nevertheless proved dusty and bumpy and hot. On a trip from Camp Apache to Prescott, she observed that the jolting threw us by turns against the sides of the ambulance, and we all got some rather bad bruises. Others reported similar experiences. Army Lieutenant George G. Burke's trip in a buckboard featured cold, hunger, and terror. The ever-present cacti caused several runaways when the animals had struck against the adhering horns of the protiferous cholla. Nevertheless, buckboards and ambulances made touring Arizona more practical. Josephine Clifford, the wife of an Army officer, rather enjoyed her desert adventures by wagon. "My ambulance was of such ample dimensions," she wrote, "that it was easily turned into a sleeping apartment for the night. Drawn by four large mules, this vehicle enabled Mrs. Clifford to tour southern Arizona in a style befitting a lady." During the late 1850s, the Army attempted an exotic transportation experiment in hope of finding a better way to move men and materials across the Southwest. The U.S. Camel Corps was a favorite idea of Secretary of War Jefferson Davis, who envisioned camels as the answer to transportation needs in the parched Southwest. Davis purchased 77 camels in 1856-57. These animals could carry loads up to 600 pounds, were comfortable in any terrain, drank little water, and ate plants shunned by other animals. 25 of these remarkable beasts were assigned to Lieutenant Edward F. Beale, who in 1857 led an expedition to construct a wagon road from New Mexico to California. His camels exceeded expectations as they trekked across northern Arizona. Writing from a camp near present-day Holbrook, he remarked that certainly there was never anything so patient and enduring and so little troublesome as this noble animal. Unfortunately, Beale's enthusiasm was not always shared by his men. Camels hardly endeared themselves to dedicated horse soldiers. Horses and mules fled in terror, creating havoc with teamsters and infuriating packers. In addition, the camels were noisy, ornery, spat incessantly, and emitted an odor so obnoxious that one expert advised handlers to pitch your tent as far as from your camel as you dare, and if there be a breeze, to the windward. Most troopers hated the beasts. Because of the Army's unwillingness to accept this unconventional means of transport, Beale's experiment was not repeated. More conventional modes of travel seemed better suited for Arizona. As people entered the territory, commercial travel firms began to emerge and water transportation played a major role. Until well after the coming of the railroad, a fleet of small stem-wheeled steamboats traversed the Colorado River, supplying mining camps and army posts from Yuma to Fort Mojave. People destined for the interior also went upriver before heading overland to Prescott. Although equipped with some comforts, the riverboats were nonetheless miserable and dangerous. If river travel was unpleasant, much the same could be said for stagecoaches, Arizona's most common form of travel. Stagecoaches came early to Arizona and they lasted until after the turn of the century. Even after railroads connected the major towns, coaches were used to reach remote sites. Sometimes regarded as a horse-drawn hill, the first regular stagecoach service appeared in Arizona in 1857 as part of a line connecting San Antonio, Texas with San Diego, California, named the Jackass Mail because passengers were forced to ride mules across the sand dunes west of Yuma. This enterprise quickly collapsed, replaced by the famous Butterfield stage. Although stage service was disrupted during the Civil War, regular connections resumed after the conflict. All agreed that stage travel was uncomfortable. Most passengers naturally preferred short trips. In a territory as large as Arizona, however, wayfarers frequently had to suffer through extended journeys. Despite fear, lack of sleep, and bruising, most passengers safely reached their destination. However, those traveling long distances faced one more threat: meals at a stage station. Designed as stops to change teams, some stations offered food. These feasts generally consisted of boiled salt pork with chilies and water added to the fat for gravy. Wayfarers unlucky enough to eat such a chow reacted much the same. The bill of fare, outside of an occasional item of game, was abominable, consisting of chicory coffee sweetened with molasses or brown sugar, fried pork floating in grease, and cornbread soggy and unpalatable. Yet even here a spirit of optimism might appear. One man thought his meal better than could be expected so far from civilized districts. Another called his breakfast fit for a king. As Arizona developed economically, it became necessary to move a substantial amount of freight and merchandise. Eventually, a large freighting system grew up, employing hundreds of wagons, thousands of mules, oxen, horses, and scores of teamsters or bullwhackers. Because of its proximity to supply houses in Sonora, Tucson became the center of freighting activities. Dominated by the firm of Tully and Ochoa, Tucson served as a hub for wagon trains connecting the mines with Sea of Cortez ports and eastern terminals. In the 1870s, more men were employed in freighting than any other occupation except mining. Prior to 1880, all mining and smelting equipment was brought in by wagon. Trains consisting of dozens of wagons crisscrossed Arizona daily. Even the territory's first narrow-gauge locomotive, built in Pittsburgh for the Coronado Railroad at Clifton, entered Arizona by wagon. Conversely, tons of copper, gold, and silver went to market the same way. Indeed, modern technology assured that mule-drawn wagons, stagecoaches, and steamboats become obsolete. Today, one may look back on such means of travel as romantic and quaint, yet we need to keep things in perspective. Most 19th century Arizonans would have agreed with one wayfarer whose trip was so unpleasant that she remarked, "I made an inward vow that nothing would ever force me into such a situation again." And this concludes The Trials of Travel in Early Arizona. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.